Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call to order the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Thank you all very much for being here. Today's Thursday, the 2nd, our second day for the session. We have a couple of different things. It looks like we have no work session scheduled for possible bills of introduction today. We are going to do two informational hearings, and we're going to be playing it by ear regarding the two public hearings and work sessions. Just to let everyone know, including the president, since one of the bills is his, it looks like we don't have fiscals on SB 5 or SB 26. If we don't get them while we're in, while the committee is in meeting before we adjourn, then we'll have to set those over for work sessions. But hopefully some magic will be worked and we'll have fiscals on both of those. So with that said, it looks like we're going to start with an informational hearing. And we're going to start at the top of the informational hearing, which will be an overview of the Oregon Department of Justice. And we have Fred Boss that's going to be here. Fred, thank you for being here. I understand Aaron's not able to make it, so it looks like you're running solo.
Yes, Chair Brzezinski, he abandoned me. So I will be running solo, and hopefully I don't get chastised later. I have hopefully passed out an organization. I'm sorry. My name is Fred Boss. I am the Deputy Attorney General, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. I'm here to give an informational overview of the Oregon Department of Justice. Hopefully you have before you an organizational chart of the Department of Justice, and I would like to just go through this briefly so to give you an idea of what we at the Oregon Department of Justice do. The Oregon Department of Justice is a statutorily created entity in Chapter 180. So Chapter 180 creates for Oregon an Attorney General and allows her to have such Assistant Attorney General as she needs, incorporated all within the Department of Justice. We have nine divisions, if you count the Office of the Attorney General. The Office of the Attorney General is primarily administrative and houses the Attorney General and me and some support staff, but generally we are more of an overview and a managing entity to the other divisions. The first division I'd like to talk about is our Criminal Justice Division. We in the Oregon Department of Justice have very little primary jurisdiction, primarily some corruption statutes we can go in and initiate on our own. But for the most part, we serve as aiding the state's 36 district attorneys. And we provide expertise in certain areas, financial crimes, internet crimes against children. So we have developed specialties in which we go in and assist the district attorneys who are, of course, focused on violent crimes in their various counties. We also come in on conflicts. So if in a particular county, for example, a judge has a DUI, then the prosecutor doesn't want to prosecute them, we come in and handle those. For a lot of the smaller counties, we handle the more violent crimes. So if the smaller counties, primarily on the east side, if they have a capital murder case, we have capital murder teams that come in, investigate, and prosecute. We will either prosecute for them or we will assist them in the prosecution so that we can help out folks. Some counties just have one DA and they just don't have the organization. We come in and provide that organization. Chair? Okay.
You're doing great.
Thanks. I'll slow down. We also have a criminal intelligence section, and we serve as a clearinghouse for criminal information coming from the federal government, also from various state and county law enforcement, and shoot them out to lying law enforcement officers. And probably one of the an example of that. We had a couple who went on a killing spree, started in Washington, came through Oregon, and then went in down to California. We served as a clearinghouse, sending out information about this couple, and the highway patrolman that eventually caught them saw, as the highway patrol have the laptop computers, as you'll see in their cars, he got the information we pumped out from our fusion center with the license plate and description of the car and description of the couple came up just as he was in the car in front of him happened to be that, and he pulled them over and successfully arrested them. The next division I'd like to talk about is our appellate division. We handle all of the criminal appeals in the state of Oregon. So the 36 counties, the district attorneys prosecute criminal actions. If there is an appeal, the defendant's allowed to appeal. We handle the appeals through the Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court, and eventually I'll talk about the post-conviction relief. So our appellate division handles all of the appeals for the criminal appeals for the state of Oregon. That's about 80% of their work. We have about 20% of their work where they handle appeals for various state agencies and litigation that the state's involved in, and they handle that up to the Supreme Court of the United States also. The appellate division, in conjunction with our trial division, handles what we call the defense of criminal conviction. So I've talked about the criminal appeals. Well, a criminal defendant is also allowed to have what we call post-conviction relief, so that primarily focuses around the competency of their defense counsel. So we have an intermix between our appellate division and a group in our trial division that handles the post-conviction relief. Those cases bounce between the appellate division and the our trial division. They are both in state court and in federal court because people who are convicted of crimes can seek habeas corpus relief from the federal courts. Our trial division also handles the defense of lawsuits against the state. Their primary client is our risk management group in administrative services. The state is self-insured. We have a pool that acts as the insurance company. That our trial division acts as the insurance defense attorneys for the state. They also take on other responsibilities that aren't covered by the insurance fund, but their primary activity is defending the state sued for various torts that would be covered by the insurance. Next section is our civil enforcement division. That is kind of a catch-all division that actually is the civil entity that sues on behalf of the state. And I'd like to go through kind of their sections because it is a potpourri of activity. One is our charitable activities section. The Attorney General is both an enforcer in the charities and charitable solicitation area, and also a regulator. Charities, and there are about 20,000 charities now, yearly register with the Attorney General's office and file with us their tax returns so that we know that they are promoting a charitable purpose. We audit those returns. We audit that they are actually providing charitable services. We also go and enforce folks that are using charitable entities to perpetuate fraud. We also do enforcement in charitable solicitation. So if you get calls at night and there are people who are saying, I represent the sheriffs and give me $20,000 or whatever, give me $20 and I will send some kids to the circus. A lot of those people are just blatant frauds or they're giving one penny to charities. Well, we regulate and enforce in that particular area. We also have a group that handles bankruptcy and generally suing on behalf of state agencies to recover money. Unfortunately, some state agencies get defrauded. They have to sue folks that defraud them or have breach of contracts just like any other business entity, they sometimes are sued and they sue. Well, there's a group in the civil enforcement that actually sues to recover money for state agencies. We also have a group that is called our Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section, a fairly large group that we enforce the consumer protection laws of the state of Oregon. We also do a lot of education. So we are out with senior centers and promoting on social media and doing all sorts of activities to make people aware of their rights as consumers. Also, we try as best we can, using Twitter nowadays, to get the latest scams out to people, because the scam artists are moving as fast as we do. So we can shut down a particular scam, but they pop up again. So we try and get out the word to Oregonians so that they're aware that that phone call at night is a scam, and they shouldn't be agreeing to pay the prince in Nigeria a bunch of money. Also, we have a group that enforces fraud that prosecutes fraud in the Medicaid realm. So in order to receive Medicaid funds, we have to have a prosecutorial unit that both civilly and criminally prosecutes fraud, primarily provider fraud, doctor fraud, making up bills, that kind of thing. So we have a unit of about 20 that investigates and prosecutes fraud, both with Medicaid providers and in nursing homes. And so often, unfortunately, there is fraud in nursing homes. We do that in this group. Finally, we have a large group of attorneys, almost around 50 attorneys, work with the Division of Child Support, DHS on child advocacy. So when if a child has to be removed from their home, our lawyers involved in that on almost every phase of that removal. We also have, moving down, and I'm going from my right to left, a victim services section. So we provide grants, or we have our administer grants to all of the DAs and to various organizations that provide services to crime victims. Each district attorney's office has a crime victims coordinator, and we finance that through funds that we pass through. We also in Oregon have a system in which if you are a victim of a violent crime, you can seek compensation from us for your lost wages, to pay your medical bills and things like that. We in turn around and get that from the perpetrator of the crime, so as to keep a revolving account. We also provide our own victim services. So if address confidentiality, for example, if they're in certain domestic crimes, the victim does not want the perpetrator of the crime to know their address. Well, we provide an address service so that their mail comes to us and then we disperse it so people don't know who they are. We also have a general counsel division, and that's exactly what it sounds like. We provide counsel to all state governmental agencies, try and keep them out of trouble, give them advice on the law. We do have a child support program. So 50% of the Department of Justice is basically a huge law firm. And we say that we are the largest law firm in the state, and actually we are by about 50 or 60 lawyers. The other half of the Department of Justice is the state's child support program. And we collect and disperse child support payments. For both for folks that have been on public assistance and for just private folks that are divorced. This unit, it's a large division. I think they say that they collect and distribute $1 million a day. So it's around $365 million passed through this program each year. We something that's required by federal law, so it's a quasi-federal program. We do receive around 66% of our funding from the federal government for this particular program. Finally on here, we have administrative services section. We are a state agency. We have HR. We have IT. We have all that. And that's, we house that in our administrative services section. That's what keeps the rest of us running. That's an overview of what we do. I could actually, it's my favorite topic to talk on, and I can talk for hours. But I want to give you kind of an overview of what we do, and I would be happy to take any questions you have.
All right, Fred, thank you. Let me ask, anyone on the dais here have any questions at this point as to the overview?
No questions.
I do. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Where in the org chart does the civil rights entity reside?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Dembro, in actually two places. The civil rights outreach is a function of the Attorney General's office, and the Civil Rights Director is in the Attorney General's office. The civil rights, to the extent that he is prosecuting cases, is housed in the Civil Enforcement Division. So he has two offices and actually kind of splits his time between outreach efforts and actual litigation work.
Okay, and just to follow up, I know that the Attorney General is proposing legislation to dealing with the area of profiling, and if that's successful, where would that reside? You know, the her office is reviewing, overseeing the way that local governments are dealing with profiling.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Dembro, I believe that will be with our civil rights director and would be housed primarily for that function, I believe, in the Civil Enforcement Division. But I have not been on the task force, and Mr. Knott has deserted me.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? All right, Fred, thank you very much. So just for everyone, as you know, boiling us down, the Attorney General is really the attorneys for the state, and they help us in both, defensive where something comes against us or we have to be going forward to protect rights. And clearly there's issues that are, let's say, being looked at. I'm not saying that we're going to be utilizing it, but I think we may be utilizing where the state will be trying to protect citizens' rights as to what might happen at the federal level, depending on how things play out. So this will be a quite interesting opportunity for us to learn a little bit more about what the Department of Justice does, because I think it's going to be a little bit more action-packed. So, Fred, thank you very much.
Yes, thank you. All right.
Yeah, that's quite all right. Thank you very much for your time, and appreciate it. All right, so we're going to go ahead and close that overview informational hearing. We're going to go ahead and open up our second one, which is on an overview of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. We have Mike Cole Schmidt. Mike is the director of the commission, and we will see Mike probably on more than one occasion. So thank you for being here and giving us this overview.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, thank you for having me to talk to you about what the Criminal Justice Commission does. My name is Mike Schmidt. I'm the director of the commission, have been since 2015.
And Mike, before we get going, I think would you prefer having questions as we go through the presentation?
Yeah, that's absolutely. That'd be great.
If you have questions, don't wait. Let's go ahead and get it, because I think it would be better attuned to whatever we're discussing, have the questions with it.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Okay. Chair. So I want to kind of just give you an overview of the work that we actually do. We're a tiny state agency. There are 11 staff at the Criminal Justice Commission. Sometimes it feels like we're twice that because my staff is so good and works so hard. But I'm very fortunate to have a fantastic staff, and we do a ton of work. And so I just want to give you an idea of all the different areas we touch in criminal justice. And like Chair said, questions as we go. So I thought I'd start off with a little history, and some of you are probably more familiar with this history than I am, but you know, useful to look back at where we are today versus where we got started. And back in 1983 was as far back as I saw the idea of what became the Criminal Justice Commission today got started, and that was with the Oregon Prison Overcrowding Project established in 1983, and it was to address prison overcrowding, much like a position that we're in today for the CJC, a lot of the work that we do. So that's how we got our roots back in 1983. And that's morphed several times throughout the decades. We then were tasked with studying in 1985 the OCJC, the council, studying making recommendations again on capacity of facilities in the state, prisons. And that turned into 1989 in the sentencing guidelines, which is still work that we do today. And I'll talk about that in a second. But when we went from a indeterminate sentencing system to a determinate sentencing system, essentially meaning that we went from a system where a judge in a courtroom would say, all right, the punishment for this crime is 10 years, and then you would end up going to the parole board and you would serve any time between 0 and 10 years in the prisons. The state changed to a determinate sentencing system in 1989. Where we established guidelines for presumptive sentences for all of the felony crimes. And that was with an eye towards looking at resources that the state has, and then also parity across different crime types. And since that time, the Criminal Justice Commission has been the steward of the sentencing guidelines. And then 1995, the Criminal Justice Council sunset. And it was replaced by another, the actual commission. And then from there in 2005, the CJC really got more involved with doing grants, public safety grants. We became the state administering agency, which means that we administer some federal grants for the state. And we do a lot of pass-through grants from general fund, mainly in back in 2005 on specialty courts, drug courts. And now to the present with the Justice Reinvestment Grants. So we've kind of had, you know, morphed a little bit over time, but a lot of the different iterations, our focus is on resources and doing public safety in the state. These are our current commissioners. The chair is one of our commissioners, so he's well aware, but our current commissioners that sit, we have representation from around the state. You see Lane County, Marion, Josephine, Klamath County. So we've got good representation from around the state, and they also occupy various roles within public safety. So we have a district attorney, we have community corrections director, we have defense attorney, and so on. So we kind of have the players represented. This is our mission statement and kind of out of our statutory authority. We are to provide a centralized and impartial forum for statewide policy development and planning. So we do a lot of work with that, with stakeholders and doing data, looking at different issues. Developing a long-range public safety plan, which right now is the Justice Reinvestment Plan. Looking again at capacity, we sit on the forecasting committee for the Department of Corrections, looking at prison population forecasts. We do research. We fund courts, drug courts, and different mental health courts, veterans courts across the state. I think we have four different studies going on right now as we speak, two of which are randomized controlled trials, which is the gold standard of you know, looking at how programs are effective. We do fiscals on a lot of the bills that this committee will see on criminal justice bills. So we assist with fiscals as it relates to prison population and resources. We also do racial and ethnic impact statements, which is not something that we've done a lot of, but we have been requested to do those. That bill was passed in 2015. And then just in general, we do the guidelines and but really the kind of stats of criminal justice in Oregon. So here's the sentencing guidelines. I won't go into it too much. Some of you are probably familiar with this.
Hey, Mike, Chair, can I just ask a question about the racial ethnic impact statements? Can you remind me, Are those focused on the negative impacts, or do they also include positive impacts of legislation we pass or we propose?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Dembrough, both. It really is just for us to try to figure out and model what the impact will be. So there could be some crimes where if the sentence was to be increased dramatically, it could actually reduce disparity. For example, sex offenses. We see that the majority of people in prison for sex offenses in Oregon would be white people. So if you increase that sentence, then disparity would necessarily decrease. So, I mean, but alternatively, there are other crimes where the disparity could be increased by lengthening sentences or decreasing sentences. Disparity could be decreased. So it just depends. And our job is just to kind of look at who is in our criminal justice system and do that analysis so that you all have that information when you're making decisions.
Senator Manning.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Just kind of follow up on that. You were talking about the impact. When you're doing the assessment or the review, are you looking at the overall financial impact? We know that a lot of people, especially low-income minority, they don't have a lot of money. And how does that actually affect the entire family for a period of time? Or are those something that's taken into consideration, or that's not a part of the equation right now?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Manning, that's outside of what we do. We really are looking more at prison bed impacts, probation impacts, and looking at the numbers of people on probation. We certainly could, the analysis, you could go on to the children of incarcerated parents. You could look at, families, like you said, or entire communities a lot of their adult male population ends up being convicted of felonies. What is the impact on the community? I mean, there's really kind of no end to how far you could go out, but we really focus on what we can do, which is looking at the criminal justice system in Oregon and just forecasting what we think, based on past history, the future of the changes proposed would be. So it's not as broad, I think, is what you were asking.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So the sentencing guidelines, if you haven't seen the sentencing guidelines before, this is what attorneys refer to as the grid. You look at the severity of a crime, which the Criminal Justice Commission ranks, unless the legislature assigns a ranking of crime severity to it, which is happening more and more. And then you look at somebody's criminal history, and you essentially, the criminal history is on that A through I, and the crime severity is on the 1 through 11, and you put your finger at their criminal history, you put your finger on the severity, and you bring your two fingers together on the grid, and that is the presumptive sentence. Anything in yellow is a presumptive prison sentence for that crime, and anything below that dark black line is a presumptive probation sentence. And so that really guides the judges in what they do, and of course the parties too as they negotiate cases.
I just had some brought down, so what I'm going to do is pass these out. These are out of date. There's something to just show you kind of what Mike's going through now, and I think it will kind of give you a perspective of what we shifted to, as he said, in 1989 to try to address the issue on the prison capacity issues. And so just to make sure, so the one that's colored on the top part, that gives you everything he's going through. Then on, I think all of these, they have the different types of crimes underneath it, and it tells you what those rankings are, so on the seriousness. And then on the back are a lot of the exceptions and, let's say, one-outs that you'll find. So it's very detailed. It's been, let's say, overlay over overlay over overlay. And so at some point maybe we'll be trying to address that and kind of make it a little bit more clearer than having as many overlays.
Yes, Mr. Chair, the font can only get so much smaller.
That's
on
right.
That piece of paper.
Yeah, magnifying glasses can only read so much.
Yeah,
right?
Precisely. That what you have in front of you, what the chair passed out, is really, that is what practitioners bring into the courtroom with them. I don't think when I was a deputy district attorney, I had it on me at all times, and probably on my nightstand. You just never leave home without that. It tells you everything you need to know about sentencing in Oregon for felony sentences.
And what we'll do is we'll get the most recent one. We'll get a copied for everyone can have something so you know what we're dealing with today as to the length of the possible presumptive sentences.
And members of the committee, at any time, if any of you would like to sit down with me in more detail and have me walk through how it works, I'm happy to do that because it is a little bit daunting and complicated. I remember when I was first sat down by my boss, and you kind of feel like you're definitely drinking from the fire hose when you look at that document. So the sentencing guidelines really is a small part of what the Criminal Justice Commission does today. The legislature passes bills that modify or creates new laws, criminal laws, and our commissioners, if it's not already ranked by the legislation, will look at it and then they balance it across other parts of the grid and they determine where they think the crime severity should be. But that happens not as frequently anymore. A lot of times because the legislature does determine what the ranking will be. So that takes up some of our time. The majority of the work of the staff of the commission and of the commission is really split into kind of this MasterCard advertisement that I have created up here for grants and research. That really is the bulk of the work that the commission does these days. So I'll just go through our biggest grants. We have multiple grants. We assist jurisdictions, individual jurisdictions, in applying for federal grants to do special programs. So we have multiple funding streams and multiple grants that we take part in. But our big grants really come down to our justice reinvestment grants and our specialty court grants. And in the last biennium, This slide shows you that the justice reinvestment grants represent $38.7 million to all 36 counties. The justice reinvestment program started in 2013. In the first biennium, the investment was $15 million into grants for all 36 counties. And in the last biennium, 38.7, all counties participate in the justice reinvestment grant program. So every single county is getting some of this grant funding to work on their public safety system. The specialty court grants in the last biennium is a mix of federal and general fund dollars, but we got up to $14 million to fund specialty courts. And like I said, that is veterans courts, mental health courts, drug courts. So it's kind of a wide umbrella, but the bulk of them are the adult drug courts.
Go ahead.
Do you know the percentage between state and federal dollars in that out of that $14 million?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Linthicum, I believe the federal dollars in this biennium, it's probably not quite a third, but close to it. I think the general fund was about $10 million and the federal funding was about the balance, the $4 million or so.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Okay.
So before we go any further, you're going to do it. I was going to make certain that we're going to go into more detail on the justice reinvestment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. So to kind of go into that detail on justice reinvestment and thinking back to the overview of the commission and the history and how we started, back as the council and looking at prison crowding, in 2013, the legislature was faced again with a scenario where they were forecasted to have to be building a prison. And at that time, the forecast was calling for a prison to be built in Junction City. And it would have had to have been open and operational based on the forecast we were looking at 2013 this year in 2017. So we would have needed to have that facility up, running, staffed by 2017 if nothing changed. And that was based on the forecast. So what you have here, and it's kind of small to see, but if you follow the green line to the left, or the top line, because it's kind of hard to see it being green, that was the 2013 prison forecast. That was where we were projected to go if nothing changed in 2013. The justice reinvestment legislation passed. That legislation has kind of two components to it. One is a statutory component. There were some statutory sentencing changes made, the most significant of which in terms of prison bed savings was the short-term transitional leave portion of the statute, which allows offenders who are eligible to serve the last 90 days of their sentence in the community.
That was the most resource-saving portion, but there were others, smaller changes that were made around identity theft, some drug crimes, depending on your criminal history, and a few other small kind of changes. But the, like I said, the big statutory change was short-term trans leave. But then the other component of it was the grant program and the counties looking at their local system. And the idea behind the grant program was that if counties had additional resources, so resources to put people on supervision and to supervise them adequately and to address issues like you know, drug addiction and criminality issues with treatment dollars, with more intensive supervision, the idea was that counties would feel able to keep more people locally on probation and not feel that they had no choice but to send those folks to prison. And so the grant program subsidizes their local public safety systems, and all the counties, like I said, have made investments. And there are four goals of the justice reinvestment legislation, which is to reduce reliance on Department of Corrections resources, send less people to prison where it is safe to do. And so the way that they're doing that is also targeting reducing recidivism and holding offenders accountable while maintaining public safety. So what you can see from these graphs is the green line where we were supposed to go, where we needed to have a prison built and open in 2017, and where we actually are, which is represented by the black line. What we have here, we split out the male and the female populations because we quickly learned that those are different in terms of bed capacity in the state. When justice reinvestment was first being considered in 2013, the conversation was a lot more just around the entire prison population. But as we started going through this, we realized that, you know, women are housed in Coffee Creek, and that facility was reaching its capacity. So we might need to open additional beds, which has been the conversation around opening OSPM. And so we look at these populations discreetly now because they have different kind of capacity issues within the Department of Corrections.
Mike, why don't you explain what OSPM is so members who don't know?
Yeah, so OSPM is the Oregon State Penitentiary Minimum Facility. It's right now not housing any inmates. It has the capacity, I believe, of around 200 beds. I think it's being used by Department of Corrections as a kind of administration building at this point. But the idea was that if Coffee Creek had hit its capacity, which it has been at for the last year and a half or so, it's been right on the line. The idea was that that would be a place where we could move additional female offenders once Coffee Creek had hit its tipping point. So to open up that facility to create additional capacity for the female offenders. So
this is a facility that's out on State Street. It's where the penitentiary's at. It's another kind of a wing that's, if I remember correctly, on the grounds, but further to the east. And if I'm not mistaken, I think at one point it was where women's prison facility before we made the move to have them all in, at Coffee Creek. And so it's been dormant, mm-hmm. except for other, let's say, dormant for inmate use. And it's one of those situations that we're still trying to figure out if we can not open that facility up. It will pay more benefit back to the state as to not needing to put that type of money into that renewed investment.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that is projected to cost $17 million in the next biennium if that facility has to be open and operational.
And so, yeah, and just follow up on that. So that $17 million, that would be money. I'm not saying it would come from justice reinvestment, but it's money that wouldn't go to justice reinvestment. We know that for a fact. All right, Senator Manning first, and then Senator Dimbrough.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just, you know, when I hear about the Coffee Creek, and I know that there was some conversation about perhaps doing building another prison, I'm happy to hear that there are other alternatives where we don't, you know, invest that kind of money in those facilities. But, you know, in my district in particular, I'm wondering, you know, I have the Junction City Hospital. So I will always advocate for opportunities to maybe use that as a spillover, for lack of a better term, or consideration. You know, I like to think outside the box. You know, we're talking about saving money, saving jobs, and also providing a service that most of the time some of these offenders would need and not getting. Some of them, from my experience in law enforcement, you know, they're spontaneous when they do things, and then they live to regret it for a long period of time. Sometimes it's based off of mental health, not necessarily criminal intent. So I just want to put that out there and, you know, keep that under consideration as we move forward.
Let me just respond, and please correct me if I'm wrong. My understanding is that when we built the Junction City facility, if you remember, it was going to be a joint or dual campus. It was going to have the minimum security prison plus the state hospital facility and have common operations in the middle that would basically take care of, let's say, food, laundry, and all that type of stuff. In that discussion and when they were looking at that, my understanding is that the facility that is now open there was actually built to specs to meet prison requirements, in the sense that they actually have fortified walls that are what was required for a prison built at that way. So if and when we want to or need to make a change, that could become a corrections facility that would probably have the specialty use. That's my understanding. So I'm going to go out there on the limb, and we'll just see if the corrections gets back to me and say, oh, no, that's not true. But I think the foresight was, in fact, because when Vicki Walker was pursuing this, and that was part of the discussion she and I had when she was serving as a senator, that they were looking ahead, not knowing if we would need to retain that facility as a mental health facility that would not be under the correction. So how could you make the investment on that front end, knowing that we may need to use it for another intended purpose?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Devereaux.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mike, you know, as I look at those charts, I see a fairly dramatic difference between the male and the female in terms of the impact of 3194. Can you explain why the impacts are so much less for the female population?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dembro, they really are two different populations in a lot of ways. When we look at the crime types that end up being the majority of sending women to prison versus men, it's very different. Men, by and large, are going to prison for violent crimes. The percentage of men going to the prison are for those types of crimes. For women, that's not the case. Property crimes actually make up the highest percentage of crime type for women. This past year, so we've been looking at this very closely, identity theft and theft in the first degree are the two crimes that send women to prison the most in Oregon. So it's a very different type of population. When the Justice Reinvestment Program and the legislation, House Bill 3194, were being crafted, I don't think that they weren't thinking in terms of the two different populations and the way it might play out differently. So we have tried with the grants, and counties have participated in looking at programs that could more target the women's population and the kind of criminogenic factors and concerns that are specific to that population. But we're kind of playing catch up a little bit. So the big difference is that there's just the property crimes have just been sending a lot of women to prison, and the men, you know, not as a percentage as much.
So how does that translate then into less benefit from 3194?
Yeah, you would actually kind of think the opposite, that there'd be more benefit, because 3194 targeted sentences in property crimes and drug crimes. And so you'd think proportionally women would receive more benefit. It just hasn't played out that way. So, you know, it's a tough question. I don't think we know entirely why it hasn't had as big of an impact on that population, because you would kind of assume it might.
Just one follow-up. So are women participating in short-term transitional leave as much as men are? You know, if you had said that's a large part of the beneficial impact.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Dembro, actually they participate in it in terms of proportionately a lot more. They are much more likely to receive short-term transitional leave than their male counterparts. I don't know if it's 2-1, but it's it's a percentage, a significant percentage more likely for women to get it than men.
And so are the grant dollars then less for the female population? Is that perhaps where the different impact is?
Well, the grant dollars aren't specific that way. And so it's really up to the local public safety coordinating councils to determine how they want to enhance their local services and treatment options. But, you know, when we go around and talk to the counties, it really is kind of county by county, but we hear that there just aren't as many beds for women, for example, treatment beds or, you know, housing that is for women. So I think some counties have looked at and taken steps to address that with their justice reinvestment dollars, and it's definitely a conversation we're having with all 36 counties, but it's a growing population for sure.
Okay, Senator Nutzig.
Mike, I'm not sure I recognize what the left-hand scale on these graphs represents. You mentioned 200 beds there at the female population. The number where that line is 1280. What's going on with capacity, and what do those numbers actually represent?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Linthicum, thanks for the question. That axis, those numbers are offenders, so number of inmates in prison. The 1280 is the and the reason it's got the line there is because that is the line that Department of Corrections has said that is our max capacity for that facility to house offenders.
On an annual basis?
At any one time. So any day you go in there, if they have more than 1280 offenders being housed in Coffee Creek, they will be over capacity.
So these graphs don't represent bed count for based on female-male population. It's overall bed count.
These are broken out into male and female. So I know that's really small. The one on the left is just the male bed count. The one on the right is just the female bed count. So the Coffee Creek is the only facility in the state that houses the female population right now, which is why it has that capacity line at 1280.
Okay. And then being somewhat new to judiciary, right? I got my first bill to carry yesterday.
He's studying on it all last night.
Explain the distinct pattern.
Another great question. There's a seasonality to prison inmates and admits in Oregon. And it kind of makes sense when you think of, you know, snow closures, right? ice knocking down people's ability for courts to process cases, things like that, holidays, vacations. So we kind of see this winter, summer rise and fall. And it really is more about how cases are processed through our system and just natural times where there's kind of ebb and flow. So that's why you get that kind of annual humping aspect that you see.
Thank you. One last question in terms of follow-up. As we're talking about facilities and bed count and Deer Creek and those kinds of things, your office must have a chart that describes funding availability and bed counts at the county level as well as at the state level. Do you have it may be printed this small, but nevertheless, do you have something that gives us a good overview of the entire system? And secondly, does it include counties? I mixed them in there, but they may not come under the same umbrella.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Linthicum, are you thinking of jail capacity in local counties?
Yes.
We don't have a chart that lays that out county by county. You know, I think we could go through in our justice reinvestment programs. We have those dialogues with counties. For example, you know, talking to Josephine County, we know that right now their jail is seriously being threatened to be closed completely. So we have those conversations, but we don't have it kind of spelled out. It's something that we could request from the Sheriff's Association. I think OSSA would definitely have that. The prison capacity, the Department of Corrections would know each facility's capacity. We kind of just look at the lines that they give us for what their capacity is and put it into our prison count charts.
Sure. Okay.
All right, so just a time check. We have two bills that we're going to take testimony on. So I'm not sure, Mike, what do you think? How much more time do you need? Oh,
I can go through the rest really quickly.
Okay, so if you can kind of do it in 5 minutes or so, that way we'll transition to the other two, because we do have a number of people that are here to testify. And the only other thing I do want to do is caveat. I said Vicki Walker. I think I should have said Val Hoyle was the person I had the conversation with, because she was the one that was kind of the point person at that time. Vicki had already moved into another arena.
All right, 5 minutes, Mr. Chair. So just to wrap up justice reinvestment, the LPSC, or the Local Public Safety Coordinating Council, which we'll be talking about in a minute on a bill in front of you, is the deciding body in the county of where the justice reinvestment funds go. CJC gives quarterly updates to all the LPSCs and regionally the LPSCs on how the program's going and how prison's being used.
So, Mike, one of the things I guess I was going to say, this is very important for the committee, because this is going to be a lot of the work that we're going to do. So I'm going to offer, if you want to come back and do some additional preview, we can work that in. I think we have enough flexibility this next week, because I really don't want to rush you. Mm-hmm. So why don't we take that in consideration of how you want to present?
Okay. Yes, Mr. Chair. Absolutely. That'd be great. So I won't go into too much depth in any of these things, and I can come back and talk, you know, drill down a little bit more about your questions. But we also do the specialty courts. CJC funds 36 different or 38 different specialty courts across the state. We do a lot of research. We got recognized nationally this past year for two different research papers that we did, which was really great. We swept the awards for the small state analysis commissions. So that was really exciting for us. And like I said, we have four different research projects going on right now in counties all across the state who we're working with. This is what I think hopefully will be of most interest and use to you. If you go to the Criminal Justice Commission website, we have a page on interactive dashboards. These dashboards, you can click on them, and you know, if you are a data nerd like myself, just get lost and spend hours. I mean, you can click through and see every county's prison usage, average length of stay, by crime type, by any different categories you want. We break it down by race and ethnicity. So all kinds of different things. We also have our justice reinvestment grant programs in there, so you can click on anywhere in the state and see how they're spending the justice reinvestment grant dollars, where they allocated those dollars. I think it's one of the most transparently run grants that I've seen. The public can see immediately how the LPSC has allocated those funds. So happy to again sit down with any of you, and maybe that would be a great thing to come back on and go through some of the dashboards and how they're used. We also did a joint project with the DPSST, and it's called the Oregon Knowledge Bank. Again, this is kind of a first of its kind in the nation, although we're getting calls from everywhere wanting to replicate it. This is specific to Oregon. These are programs that are working in all the different counties. They submit them to us, and we kind of give the cliff notes of what programs are happening. It's for police officers. It's for community corrections agencies and community corrections folks to look at how are other counties, how are other jurisdictions tackling some of the same problems that everybody's facing. So it's just a way to share information about what's working in Oregon. It's not necessarily an evidence-based. You can't go on there and say, well, this program is evidence-based. But what it gives you is the idea of how is another jurisdiction tackling this specific issue. So we're very proud of this. Another way you could definitely lose a couple hours if you were interested. And then I'll leave off with the Justice Reinvestment Summit. I know that this committee and the House Judiciary Committee are planning to attend the summit on Friday, but I encourage you, if your schedule allows, and I know you're all very busy, spend as much time as you can Thursday and Friday, the 16th and 17th. We have over 800 Oregonians registered to come who touch public safety across this state. It's pretty unbelievable. We are almost to the point of selling out the Salem Convention Center, and I don't think there are many hotel rooms left in the city. So it'll be a great time for you to see folks from all different walks, judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, treatment professionals. We're all gathering to talk on a wide variety and host of public safety issues. So it'd be great to have you all there, and hope you can get something out of that. So with that, I can definitely work with the chair and council to figure out what would be most useful for me to come back and drill down into a little bit more.
All right, Mike, that would be great. Let me just, if there's any pressing questions based on what's been presented at this point, let's go ahead and take those now. If not, we're going to table this and we'll come back, because this is a core area that we'll be working this session, and I think it's real important for those who have not been part of the process to fully understand and appreciate some of the hurdles we've overcome and some of the hurdles we still face. So thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So I'm going to go ahead and close the public, the informational hearing, I should say, on the overview for the CJC. We will be rescheduling that, working with Chana and others to make certain we don't tip the schedules on other presentations that are scheduled at this point. With that, we do have the ability to start doing some of our hearings. And at this point, we have the fiscal back on SB 26. So I know those individuals are veterans in giving us testimony, and I know that, as veterans, they can be very quick. So we'll open up a Senate Bill 26 for a public hearing. And Josh.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 26 directs county commissions to appoint a provider of victim services to the local public safety coordinating council.
I have three individuals that are scheduled to give testimony, all in favor. So Nikki, Mike, and Patrick, if you three would please come forward at the same time. And I'll let you present in whatever order you think is best.
If I give the overview.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mike Schmidt, Director of the Criminal Justice Commission, you might remember. So thank you for hearing this bill. Really, I just want to give you a quick background. Council already summarized a very straightforward, simple bill. The local public safety coordinating councils in all 36 counties are the bodies that administer the Justice Reinvestment Grant funds. So they are the entity that we work with in making those funding decisions. When we started that program in 2013, we had a lot of feedback from the LIPSICs at when they got to the point that 10% of their grant funds have to be dedicated to community-based nonprofit organizations that provide services to victims of crime. So we had a lot of feedback from the LIPSICs that they might not even know somebody in their local community. They didn't know where to turn. And so we got questions. Well, who should we give this money to? Where does it go? What is? And it became apparent to us that in many, but not all, LIPSICs, that this community and the Public Safety Council weren't necessarily, they didn't know each other. They weren't necessarily talking or coordinating or working together. So out of that experience, we came up with the idea of, well, wouldn't it make sense to have somebody from that community actually sit on the LIPSIC so that they could give that perspective of how these communities work together? Clearly, public safety touches both sides. And so the idea was just simply to put somebody from that community onto the LIPSIC so that they could help the LIPSIC in making those funding and resource decisions, and more broadly just foster a dialogue and build relationships between that community and the public safety community. So that's why we requested the bill.
Patrick, are you next?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Patrick Singh. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. So LIPSICs, as Director Schmidt mentioned, have been a very successful arena for public safety collaboration over the years. Depending on the county, some LIPSICs meet more frequently than others, and then in some cases their activities vary in addition to what's kind of required by statute. With the Justice Reinvestment Act, LIPSICs have strengthened their work even more around the grants and around expanding collaboration with mental health and healthcare stakeholders and victim services programs. AOC, we're privileged to have a very strong and strategic partnership with the Criminal Justice Commission in not only supporting LIPSICs, but a lot of public safety projects, including justice reinvestment grants. So wanted to take the opportunity to thank Director Schmidt for his leadership and the work of his staff at the commission and what they do. This past year, we worked with the CJC to make sure that LIPSICs returned back to their annual reporting of data. So we had kind of the groundwork of what LIPSICs do in addition to what's statutorily required. And that kind of helped, again, lay the groundwork for our next collaborative project, which is a federal grant that the CJC received for a three-year project, which AOC was selected to administer to fund six regional coordinators in rural counties throughout the state. So we have six employees of AOC that are out in the field working with LIPSIX. Three of them are working in counties that you represent. We have a coordinator in Klamath and Lake County. We have a coordinator in Polk and Yamhill County. And then we also have a coordinator in Douglas and Josephine County. These folks started on January 1st, so they are in the field now, working with their LIPSIX to become as efficient and effective as possible. And I'm happy to come back another time or meet with you individually with Director Schmidt to talk more about the program and the work that they are doing. So again, thank you for the opportunity. We support Senate Bill 26.
Nikki.
Thank you. Nikki Terzieff, good morning, here on behalf of the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. We are the statewide nonprofit that provides technical assistance, training, and administers grant funding from where you heard earlier today, the DOJ, through the Crime Victim Services programs. We have nonprofits all over. These are the folks that meet like Marta's House. We have PWCL, Women's Space in Eugene. These are the nonprofit programs that meet somebody in the most traumatic time. And to provide these programs a seat at the table with public safety is key. We are thrilled about this bill because what it does is it represents the other at least 50% of the voices in the community who don't seek out a district attorney, who don't seek out prosecution. To lift up the voices of those who don't want to report but still deserve services and justice, and we think that this is one vehicle to do it. So we'd like to thank the commission for bringing it forward and urge an aye vote.
Thank you. Any questions for anyone on the panel? Thank you all very much. Let me ask if there's anyone else in the room that wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 26. Not seeing anyone raising their hand or rushing up, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing. And we do have the fiscal, as I said, so we'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 26.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 26 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 26 with a due pass recommendation to the floor. Is there any discussion on the bill? Is there any objection to the motion? So be it. And Senator Manning, as I promised, and I will deliver, you will be our hopefully our carrier on this. I will ask if you'll be so kind.
I will.
Excellent answer. So we have that. We'll close the work session with Senate Bill 26. And we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 5. And at this point, I have... My gosh, the president is here. I didn't, you know, have the Secret Service come in first. I was really surprised. Normally we have that. So, Mr. President, thank you for being here. And Lane and Jeff, you all are going to be joining them. Great. So, Mr. President, I'm going to give you the floor and the lead, unless you want to defer.
Okay. Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Peter Courtney. I'm a state senator, District 11, here in Salem. Here to support Senate Bill 5, I appeared before your committee in interim on this, what I call the sports agent bill, so I'll be brief. Some 6 years ago, I joined with representatives from the University of Oregon to introduce an athletic agent bill. And while I've delivered written testimony to you and I've cited an article in Sports Illustrated, we didn't have to actually go to Sports Illustrated to understand the magnitude of sports agents contacting student athletes and sometimes through their contracts within them, the student athletes would end up losing their eligibility and the coaches that were involved would also be ended up being fired over it because there are rules and regulations on these agents approaching our student-athletes at all our institutions in the state of Oregon. It's not just usually, as you know, I don't know any of you that well, but I know enough of you well that some of you are basically associated with what you call Division I sports. But there are student-athletes, Western Oregon's Division II, Willamette's Division III. There's even NAI schools. I think Southern Oregon University is NAIA. They're involved in what you call scholastic athletics and agents. Because you could even have people, students, athletes, as the chair knows, who may not be at Division I, but they do have the potential to play professionally. And while it used to be just male-dominated, we do have women's professional basketball now. Track and field is really trying to move into that area. Soccer, et cetera. So it is men and women. So the long and short is we passed the bill, and actually, I believe in the certified smarts are here, we may have led the nation with that sport agent bill. Since then, other states have actually moved ahead of us. One of them is even Alabama because of this situation. And so this, in effect, sets rules and regulations. That's my words to say, if you're going to be a sports agent and coming in the state of Oregon, this is what you better do, or you're going to get into trouble. And I do think, I'm just going to end there to say this updates it, because I'm joined by the Law Commission's renowned Lane Shetterly, a former state representative, and, of course, an outstanding lawyer from the Dallas area. And the Hawk, Mr. Hawkins, as they call him, on the campus of the University of Oregon. He is the director of football operations. He's also an associate athletic director there. And it was Jeff Hawkins who helped me several years ago on this. So U of O really took the lead here. Oregon State was also involved, but U of O took the lead. So thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to sit here and listen to their testimony. I appreciate you willing to take this bill up so early in the session. And I hope you'll feel strongly enough about it that you might find a way to pass it out. But with that, I will turn it over, I guess, to you, Mr. Shetterly. Is that correct?
Sure. Yeah, before we do that, one of my mistakes in the early session, I should have given Michael the opportunity to make his presentation as to kind of putting on the record what the bill will do. So, Michael, why don't you give us that, and then we'll go back to Lane.
Thank you. Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 5 amends statutes related to student agent athletes. Senate Bill 5 broadens the definition of athlete agent and requires the disclosure of additional information at the time of registration. In addition, Senate Bill 5 streamlines the registration process for athletic agents registered in other states and expands the circumstances under which athletic agents must notify the student's athletic director. Finally, SB 5 bans athletic agents from furnishing anything of value to a student athlete or persons connected with student athletes prior to the athlete entering a contract. There are no amendments at this time, and as you said, we do have a revenue statement, but no fiscal statement.
All right. Thank you very much, Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee. Here we go again. My name is Lane Shetterly. I am an attorney in practice in Dallas, and I'm here this morning in my capacity as a member of the Uniform Law Commission from Oregon. Just by real brief background so you know where this bill comes from, the Uniform Law Commission is an organization of the states. Each state appoints a number of commissioners to the Uniform Law Commission, and it acts something like a legislative body. Only the bills that the laws that the Uniform Law Commission adopts don't become effective on their own. Instead, what they do is they go out to the states for the states to adopt. And in adopting the Uniform Acts, then we create a system of uniform or mostly uniform laws through state action among the states. The Uniform Athlete Agents Act was a product of the Law Commission, as Senator Courtney mentioned. We adopted it here in Oregon. But as these things happen, circumstances evolve, and the act was revised by the Law Commission in 2015. And so what you have today is really amendments to our current Athlete Agents Act that conform it to the revised Uniform Athlete Agents Act that was adopted by the Law Commission in 2015. I think you can appreciate the importance of uniformity in an act like the Uniform Law Commission, where you have the interstate activity that is involved in athlete agents and athletes looking for schools and the things that get involved in that. And so this has been a very popular act. The states adopt. I think about 45 states adopted the original version. The newest one is just out. It's already been adopted, as Senator Courtney said, in Alabama, and in Washington, and in Idaho, and there are several other introductions in legislatures around the country this year. So we expect this to be adopted as effectively as the original act was. It is a regulatory act designed, as Senator Courtney said, to primarily to protect athletes from unscrupulous agents that can take advantage of them and can cause them to lose eligibility and other issues that that are regrettable. It requires registration. It requires certain notice to schools, and it also includes mandatory provisions of agent contracts. So it's, and I will say that this bill doesn't represent any substantial policy change. It is really conforming our current law to revisions to keep us uniform with the Uniform Act as it gets adopted in other states. And so that's really what this is. There's one non-uniform amendment or inclusion in the bill that I just want to point out for the record. And it's on lines 30 and 31 on page 2. It's express exclusion for basically consumer endorsement contracts. The endorsement contracts are not designed to be included in the athlete agents bill, and that companies that are engaged in consumer brand marketing are not deemed agents for the purpose of the athlete agents bill. It's a non-uniform amendment, but we've run this through the Uniform Law Commission. It doesn't affect the uniform application of the act, because in fact endorsement contracts and consumer brand marketers were not intended to be included in the Uniform Act anyway. We've just made it explicit as to that. And consumer brand marketing meaning advertising and marketing to the general public of products and services like food and beverages, mobile phones, devices, and things like that. So that amendment is a non-uniform amendment in our act, but it doesn't affect the uniform application of the bill. It's a good act, and I commend it to you for passage.
Thank you. Mr. Hawkins.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Hawkins, and I'm a senior associate athletic director at the University of Oregon, and I live in Eugene. I'm also an observer of the Uniform Law Commission subcommittee for the revision of the Uniform Athlete Agent Act, and I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 5. We cannot be complacent. There is still a problem of epidemic proportions that affects both females and males in high schools and in colleges throughout the entire state of Oregon and the country of that. Professional player salaries have escalated, and we've seen a tremendous growth in athlete agents, otherwise known as sports agents. And they have powerful economic incentives to form relationships with high school and college athletes. Unfortunately, oftentimes they use improper benefits like cash, and they put these students' education and their careers at risk. In response, we've enacted laws that are meant to regulate and punish these sports agents who break those laws. The federal civil law called SPARTA. We have won the state level Uniform Athlete Agent Act. The intention of these laws is to protect naive student athletes and their families from the sophisticated business practices of men and women who serve as agents. It also helps to create oversight in industry and to police the sometimes shadowy interactions between agents and athletes. Our goals were to standardize this registration procedures and record-keeping policies and to create a fair and practical monitoring and disciplinary system. And these laws actually create a level playing field for everybody, including the agents. Initially, the very essence of the problem was the blurred definition of what an agent was. The contract advisor, the person who actually writes the contract with the NFL team, are traditionally known as the agent, but they're now supported by a number of people like weight and speed training trainers, mentors, marketing reps, financial advisors, tutors, spiritual advisors, Dutch uncles. It goes on and on and on. Within the industry, there's also a group called runners, and they most operate totally unregulated. The runner gets paid to form relationships with players and then directs them towards an agent when it comes time to negotiate those big contracts. The problem of the runners and these specialists is that they call themselves everything but what they truly are. They're agents. By doing that, it enables them to avoid regulations, at least in their minds, that are created to protect the student athlete. And it's not just colleges that are victimized. High school athletes, even younger, think Tiger Woods, think LeBron James. They're increasingly becoming targets of these people, and they cash in on their families and their lack of sophistication by befriending them and offering them to colleges to the highest bidder. This is a big issue because runners cast a broad net. But by our analysis, most of Oregon's football players, like most college football players, think they're going to play in the NFL. Nationally, the average is 2% given on the year. When Oregon played in the national championship in 2011, we had one player drafted, Casey Martin, fourth round, and he lasted for 5 years, which is 1 year longer than the average playing career in the NFL. The public's perception is that the majority of football players go on to play in the pros. There's nothing further from the truth. Typically, 300 on a given year out of 66,000 have the opportunity to go on to play in the NFL. For those lucky 2% that make it, the average playing career is less than 4 years. And after being out of the league for 6 years, 78% are bankrupt or in financial stress. After 4 years, 60% are divorced. The lifestyle's changed. So more often than not, when they leave the pro ranks, they have no marketable skills, they don't have a job, they don't have a degree, and sometimes they're in debt. The NFL is an opportunity. It is not a career. When we passed House Bill 3296, and furthermore, Senate Bill 5 will ensure that it will make the Oregon statute consistent with the NCAA definition. So that way, anybody who's looking to make a buck on a student athlete from an institution, we can rein that in. Senate Bill 5 gives clear direction who the agent athlete has to contact at an institution. And at Oregon, we educate ad nauseum, and we have a student athlete panel that assists the parents and the athlete in the interview process. In some cases, we have saved them hundreds of thousands of dollars in ensuring, regardless of whether the athlete gets drafted or not gets drafted, there is no debt incurred upon the family or the athlete. We have conducted hundreds of these interviews and countless testimonials from these athletes and their families bestowing appreciation on us for what we do, and as we tell them, that's our job. It's also created meaningful enforcement of the law. Previously, enforcement left to local district attorneys who were left without the resources to pursue these. And although the UAAA has been on the books for 16 years and has 45 states that adopted it, there really has been no one that has effectively enforced it. In fact, because of some of the inconsistencies. It wasn't too long ago North Carolina was in trouble. They got their football players. It wasn't too long ago that an Oregon player got a $100 handshake. But he came forward, and he was honest, and that made things go away. There are many cases like this nationwide and goes on all the time. House Bill 3296 was the first step. Now we can take the next one with Senate Bill 5. Please support the revisions of the Uniform Athlete Act by supporting Senate Bill 5. It protects both the athlete and the institution from people who are far more sophisticated than the people that they victimize. Thank you for your time and attention, and can I answer any questions?
Mr. Hawkins, thank you very much. Are there any questions for anyone on the panel?
I do have a question specifically on page 2 where you're describing an athlete agent does not include an individual who, colon, you've got part A, acts on behalf of professional sports team or organization. Part B is employed by or acts solely on behalf of a publicly traded corporation. Why the qualifier for publicly traded?
Thank you, Senator Linthicum. It's a good question. That was intended to make clear that I think one of the concern is by inserting this exclusion, were we suggesting a way around it? There was a concern raised at the Uniform Law Commission, perhaps by including this exception, we're giving some unscrupulous agent an incentive to create a sham marketing company and then use that as an umbrella to go out and do what they do. So by couching it in terms of publicly traded, we know that we are dealing with legitimate and substantial business entities. And that's why we did that, to narrow that and to make sure that we don't create an opportunity for someone to use this exception to get in around the backside of the bill.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Good All question.
Right. Gentlemen, thank you very much. As we said, we are waiting for the fiscal. I did have two other people on an as-needed basis. So, Jan and TJ, I'm assuming you don't need to come up. Okay. Just they're ready to pinch hit if necessary. So, is there anyone else besides those that had signed up that wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill SB 5? Not seeing anyone come forward. I think that takes care of it. At this point, we still are waiting for the fiscal. So we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5. We will schedule Senate Bill 5 for a work session. As those who are new to the process, it requires us, before we can move a bill out of committee, after the testimony, besides having the votes that we need, we also have to have revenue and a fiscal statement. We have the revenue, but we don't have the fiscal statement, so we'll just have to wait until that catches up. And we'll probably have this scheduled sometime next week. So Mr. President will have his blood pressure go down, and we'll all live every happily after. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and I think close for the day, just make certain there's nothing else that we need to do. All right, today is Thursday, and so we will be back here on Monday, and I believe our start time is 8:30. So that, with that, we're adjourned, and everyone safe travels home or wherever you may be. Travels home or wherever you may be. We're adjourned, and everyone safe.